KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
From KUOW Seattle, you're listening to Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman. The other day, we were thinking about those songs they play at Mariners games when the players come up to bat, you know. You hear it, they play a little bar, you're like, yay, yay, Felix. Well, if someone was going to greet you with a theme song, what would that song be? You can email us right now, weekday@kuow.org, or post your theme song to our Facebook page, Weekday on KUOW. Washington state government shutdown could start today with a round of layoff notices, but lawmakers are back at work trying to come up with a new state budget. Everett Herald political writer Jerry Kornfield back with us once again. And Jerry, we thought that this would be the last time we spoke to you, but that's not probably going to be the case.
No, it's not going to be the case because they're not going to be saying goodbye to the legislative process today. And, you know, there's even a chance they'll be here next Monday trying to say goodbye, but I don't think so. I have now made my predictions that Friday will be the day that they finish on the operating and capital budget, and then we'll have to wait and see if they deal with transportation right after, or spend the weekend or more days together, or if it's just going to be over when they finish the operating budget.
Well, Jerry, some observers were predicting that the lawmakers were going to come to an agreement yesterday. What happened?
Well, you know, 3 days ago, the leadership of the Senate Majority Coalition Caucus started doing, they were tweeting, they were saying in interviews, there's no reason why we cannot finish by Sunday night. And now it looks like that was a negotiating tactic. Mm-hmm. There are, for folks who wonder, the budget's like 450, 480 pages, and line by line they go through to figure out how to spend the dollars. But there's some really big questions they still haven't resolved, and maybe they did overnight. There's no announcement yet today. But, for example, the Senate has said, we want to put $1 billion more into public schools, and here's how we want to spend it. And the House comes back and says, well, we'd like to match your $1 billion, but we don't want to spend it the same way. And so that's a philosophical difference, whether as the Senate wants to put it into learning assistance programs, school bus transportation, materials and supplies, the House wants to put it into smaller class sizes and all-day kindergarten and a little bit less into school buses and materials and supplies. So, those are philosophical differences they're still trying to work out, and as soon as they shake hands on those areas, those agreements, then it's going to come together, and it'll still take about 2 days before all the votes can start happening.
Now, you mentioned smaller class sizes. Unless I'm hallucinating, didn't voters approve an initiative calling to lower the class size?
No, you're not hallucinating, and it was a few years ago that the voters did say that. But the problem with the initiative that they passed, like that as well as for teacher pay raises, is they essentially passed an initiative that says, thou shalt do it, but they didn't put any money in those initiatives. So every year, the last couple of years, lawmakers have suspended it, saying, we don't have the money to meet the demand that the voters made of us. So they're going to, again, and this is one of the interesting parts about this $1 billion figure we're all using, it really isn't $1 billion because they're going to suspend the voter initiative for teacher salaries, which adds up to about $300 million. So they're going to start at a negative $300 million. And then they're going to start putting money into programs and training, and it'll get to $500 or $600 million new dollars. That's one area, higher education. Mm-hmm. The Senate has insisted on trying to lower tuition. Now I understand they're willing to pass a bill that says it'll be no increase in tuition in the next 2 years, and the House is saying, what happens if the colleges need to and want to raise tuition? Can't we write in some language that says, colleges, if you raise tuition, here's the terms and the rules under which you can raise it. So they're debating about higher education. Hmm. And there's still a tax bill out there dealing with the telecommunications industry, a tax exemption that is given to folks with landlines, that the cell phone operators would like that same exemption. They won a court case, and the House is saying we need to change the rule and take it away from everybody so we don't lose out a lot of money. And they're fighting over that. So, there are a handful of pretty big items, philosophical, ideological, whatever you want to call it, that is keeping them from reaching agreement on the budget.
We're talking with Jerry Kornfield of the Everett Herald. We know, because we've been hearing it for the last week, that layoff notices are set to go out today, as per law, 7 days notice for temporary layoffs. So what time of day are those going out?
Well, I mean, that's another part of this, sort of the dynamic here. I think that was the conversation on Friday. I think Senate Republicans and leaders were saying we can get done, because they did not want to see this happen. But as the weekend worked to start going, they realized they couldn't stop it. So now everyone's kind of nonplussed about the whole thing. If they have contracts, those are the rules. They got to send them out, but we'll just rescind them because we'll get a budget. Every state agency has a different contract with its employees. So I've been looking to find out if anyone has rushed them out the door so far. I do believe most are going to wait till the afternoon mail pickup. Well, they probably go out email and not snail mail. They're going to wait as long as they can. Some folks in the governor's office think that if the House and Senate held a press conference saying we've got an agreement, that might be enough to block the sending out of those of the notifications. But given that they haven't reached agreement on much for a regular session and a special session, I'm not sure you can trust a handshake at this point. You need to see some votes. So they'll start going out, but throughout the day.
Well, 34 state agencies are going to be completely shut down. We're going to see partial shutdowns in 24 others. What kinds of services are going to stop if a budget isn't reached?
Well, if you are, so many people receive something from the state, they may not realize it. Some of it's fun, the state lottery. There'll be no money to pay the employees, so you won't be able to buy a lottery ticket, or there won't be any lottery drawings. There will be other programs involving Department of Corrections. There are some convicted offenders out there that have to check in for probation, or we call it in this state community supervision. A lot of them aren't going to be supervised as tightly or at all. Some sex offenders who have been convicted, they're out in the community, they have those GPS trackers. Those trackers won't be checked as much. There's some programs where child care for women who are on, mothers who are on welfare trying to get into the working world, they won't receive their state subsidy for child care. So that it's a whole range of programs that will either be scaled back or halted. And until people start seeing them end, they won't realize how much of an impact on their lives state government has. Now, I do want to say the state has adopted, and there is a transportation budget in effect. So the Washington State Patrol is funded by that. They'll still be on the roads. You can still get a speeding ticket.
Now, you wrote on your blog over the weekend that Governor Inslee might call a third special session. Was he serious?
Well, he was kind of dragged into it under repeated questioning from reporters, because he has made as one of his sort of final priorities, he wants the legislature to vote on a transportation funding package. And this is very controversial. It would raise gas taxes by about 10 cents. And the latest proposal would raise it over 10 cents over the next 2 years. And he wants to include at least $450 million for building a new bridge on I-5 over the Columbia River. And so he's pushing for it, and he said, they need to stay here till they get it done. And when he was asked, well, does that mean you'd even call a third special session? So to focus on transportation, and he said he didn't think so, but he wasn't going to rule it out. And I think he wanted to send a message of how important it was by leaving it on the table.
Now, You mentioned that Senate Republicans are not happy about this transportation plan, in particular because of the I-5 bridge over the Columbia River between Vancouver, Washington, and Portland. Why are Republicans balking at that?
Well, I want to be clear. They don't object to having a new bridge, the one that's there, about 100 years old. I think they understand it at some point needs to be replaced. What they want to do is essentially replace the current bridge with a modernized version of it. And what the governors of Oregon and Washington want to do is they want to replace it with a bridge that also has light rail on it. And if you put light rail on a bridge between, say, Vancouver and Portland areas, you need to put the bridge lower and closer to the water. And I guess they just don't want light rail having to kind of go up and then go down. They want to keep it. So that is the problem. If you build the bridge lower to accommodate light rail, there are some industries upriver who now kind of go underneath the bridge they won't be able to. I mean, right now the current bridge, you know, is one of those. The middle will go up and down, so like the 520,
right.
And you'll be able to put freight traffic underneath it. That won't happen with a replacement bridge if it has light rail. So they've been fighting the light rail aspect of it. And at this point, they've been winning, and I'm not sure you're going to be able to get the votes in the Senate for a transportation plan as long as that bridge with light rail is in the mix.
Is it possible that that bridge could be removed? Because I know the governor is really concerned. He mentioned to us last week the Everett area, Payne Field, Boeing, that we make sure that the infrastructure is in competitive shape.
Yeah, it's a... I don't think you can trade, if you will, the Boeing factor for the bridge factor. I think this is a bridge that this is straight up or down a tough vote for members of the Senate. I do believe there's some members of the Senate Majority Coalition who would cross over and join Democrats to pass a transportation bill. The real question is if they'll be given a chance, if the leadership in the Senate will allow a vote to happen, or if the Democrats might have to use a procedural move called a ninth order to try to seize control of the chamber just to vote on transportation. I wouldn't rule it out. I think there's enough votes to do it, but whether it will or not. And the latest proposal, which is went online, actually I saw it this morning, has $650 million in this package for the Columbia River crossing, and that's the Washington share. I mean, the other thing I haven't mentioned here is part of the push is that the federal government
right.
has said we're going to chip in a big chunk, and we'd stand to lose that
right.
if the bridge doesn't go forward.
Well, it sounds like they haven't made a whole lot of progress, but I that ninth order sounds fun. It'll give you something to do while you're waiting for a budget to happen. Jerry, thank you again for being with us. Jerry Kornfield covers state politics for the Everett Herald. He's been a regular Monday guest throughout the long, long series of legislative sessions. This is Weekday on KUOW.
And he'll be with us until the bitter end, I guess. It's 9:19. The history of food in a minute.
Support for KUOW comes from the Everett Clinic, offering a wide range of minimally invasive, high-tech surgical techniques, including laparoscopy, surgical robotics, and image-guided surgery. More at everettclinic.com/tech.
56 degrees in Seattle. It's been rainy and windy this morning, and the forecast says showers the rest of the day, a high of 69. Similar deal tomorrow, Tuesday, rain at times with a high of 69 degrees. It's 9:20. I'm Bernard Ouellette. A look at how technology might impact future social change in 20 minutes.
This is Weekday. I'm Katie Sewell. We eat every single day, but we rarely pause to consider why we eat the food that we do. How did food evolve throughout history? Like, where did pasta come from, for instance, or who baked the first cupcake? When did humans start actually recording recipes in cookbooks? Well, William Sitwell has written A History of Food in 100 Recipes. He's the editor of Waitrose Kitchen Magazine, and he won Editor of the Year in 2005. Well done, William.
Thank you. I've forgotten about that. I didn't win it last night in London, so it's good of you to remind me about that one.
Well, 2005, it's not that long ago. So the book starts in ancient times. I think your first recipe comes from 1958 BC, recipe for ancient Egyptian bread. And then you move on to tiger nut sweets and roasted goat. So I was curious what you learned about the eating habits of our ancient predecessors from studying those ancient recipes.
Well, I think one of the things that I discovered is that they weren't massively different from us today. And they had to hunt and gather their food, but they were still greedy. They were still, among them, there were foodie obsessives. I mean, there's a wonderful man called Archestratus, who about 2,000 years ago wrote a book called Life of Luxury. I'm going to say it's a book. It was a poem, and it recorded all of his foodie travels through Europe at the time, which he then wrote down in ancient Greek hexameters. But what's funny about reading it is that he is obsessed about where you should get the best honey. He's obsessed about where you should buy the right sort of tuna fish. And he rails against sauces. He hates too much sauce being poured over foods. And so it did strike me that there were, you know, the idea that foodies who are very passionate and incredibly opinionated or anything new is not the case. I mean, I didn't think that I'd find myself scrambling up the dusty sides of a hill overlooking Luxor by the Nile to find one of the earliest recipes for bread. But there's this amazing tomb. It's the tomb of a woman near what was then Thebes, which is now Luxor, where inside there is the very beautifully, very accurately depictions of the bread-making process. And I had a food editor transcribe it very literally, very exactly, so you can see how they were making ancient Egyptian flatbreads. So I learned that, obviously, you know, across the course of history, things have changed immensely, particularly in the 20th century, you know, with the rise of consumerism, et cetera, et cetera. But also, there are things that have been happening for years, you know, trends that we think are new today, like trying to be economic with your leftovers. I mean, I've got a Victorian food dictionary out, and in 1812, this guy's talking about, you know, this great idea of using leftovers. And, so there's nothing new in many respects.
So in some ways, it's almost that we were not giving them enough credit. When we think of ancient cultures, we were thinking of them as so primitive and just gathering berries out in the field. But
absolutely. We think that we are massively progressive today because we have at our fingertips every single ingredient you could possibly have. But actually, as we all know, there may be 24-hour food TV, but actually a lot of us are cooking less. And I think that's regressive, not progressive. I think the less you think about food, the less you feed yourself well. And the, you know, the fast food culture actually is, I think, subversive for culture as a whole. So I think we can learn a lot by studying the way that people ate in the past and look at some of the early vegetarians. You know, I think Plato was quite a proponent for a meat-free diet. And we can learn a lot from, you know, foodies of the past.
So you said that the recipe for Egyptian flatbread was in paintings.
Yeah.
How are you seeing recipes being recorded in ancient times?
There's a group of tablets called the Babylonian tablets, which are kept at Yale. And for many, many years, people thought that these small little tablets, which are not dissimilar to the size of a modern tablet or Kindle you might have today, just recorded in ancient Arcadian cuneiform, sort of boring mathematical formulae. And it wasn't until about 10 years ago that an Egyptologist or a studier of this ancient language decided to try a new translation technique. And he discovered that one of the tablets wasn't a boring mathematical formula. It was a recipe for stew, meat stew. It's called Kanazu broth. You know, in ancient times, recipes were recorded on clay tablets. They must have been quite important because, of course, the illiterate classes weren't able to read or record stuff. As time progresses, recipes were written down on ancient manuscripts. Again, these weren't things that were used in the kitchen. I mean, there's the first ever printed cookbook came out in 1500, and it's called Boke of Cokery. And there's a copy of it in Longleat, this magnificent stately home in the south of England. And I went there to have a look, you know, put on the white gloves, sat in an air-conditioned room, look through this thing. And this wasn't a book covered in oil stains and flour. This was not a book that was used by the cook. This was a book to record feasts and record bills of fare. But there were recipes in it as well. But I think it's really only about a couple of hundred years ago that recipes start being practical. I mean, in ancient times, noblemen kept their recipes very, very secret. They liked to inspire and awe their guests, and they used to try and terrify the life out of their enemies by having them for dinner and producing a jelly that was shaped in this. They would have a dinner and produce a jelly that was the shape of their enemy's castle. So what's more kind of terrifying? You go for dinner with your enemy and he goes, ah, I know what your place looks like. Here it is in the shape of jelly. So recipes were not always practical, and a lot of ancient recipes are not very useful if you really want to just start cooking. But I mean, there's a wonderful recipe from 1475 in this book. It's for mussels, and it is as beautifully simple as you would wish to have it. You know, it's onions, mussels, white wine, and Bob's your uncle. No cream, delicious.
I'm speaking with William Sitwell. He wrote A History of Food in 100 Recipes. One of the things that came to light when I got to the Roman chapter was that ingredients were kind of hard to come by. So a lot of the things that they were trying to make had to go far and wide to be able to find what they were looking for.
That's right. And actually, a lot of the history of food is quite dull because most of the population of the world were not eating very much more than, you know, cabbage, really, boiled up stuff and a bit of poultry. I mean, meat and poultry really was was the privilege of the rich. And what's extraordinary is I think one of the most important moments in food history is in around the early 1500s, when the Spanish conquistadors start marauding their way through what's now Mexico, what they call the New Spain, and they discovered the most amazing transforming ingredients. I mean, when I'm talking about potatoes, tomatoes, chilies, turkeys, as well as gold and cocoa beans. And if you can think of it, that, you know, food around the world was very limited. It didn't have tomatoes. And actually, it was as late as 1813, there was a British horticulturalist who was saying, oh, don't go near tomatoes. They're a relation of deadly nightshade. And the first recipe for a tomato doesn't appear until 1692 in a book written by a chef in Naples, where he has a dish called salsa de pomodoro alla española, which is a tomato sauce in the Spanish style. So there was no recipe using a tomato until 1692. So you're thinking, what were they eating? Food must have been quite bland.
But Romans did sauces. Do we get sauces from them?
I always say that the Roman Empire was at its peak when its sauces were at their thickest. And their sauces were at their thickest when Marcus Gavius Apicius was cooking. And he wrote the world's first cookbook, which is still in print. And I would say that about 80% of the recipes in that book are for sauce. And he has sauce on so many things that he occasionally runs out of names. So the one I have is called Another Sauce for Fowl. So he's thinking, okay, I've done another sauce. I'll just call it Another Sauce. So the Romans were pretty big on sauce. But there were also philosophers who didn't like the idea of sauce because they thought it was a bit sort of too loose and luxurious. And food should be pared down and simple, which people still say today, don't they?
Yeah. I'm speaking with William Sitwell. He's author of the book A History of Food in 100 Recipes. Where did pasta come from?
Well, pasta, the earliest records of it that I could find are recorded from Sicily. But people say that Marco Polo discovered it. But Sicily is the point, I think, is where I think we can pinpoint it, which I think is a great relief to the Italians, who do like to claim it as their own. You know, they have a pasta museum. And, of course, I think what's interesting about pasta is that one of my great, well, I suppose, lunatic heroes from the book or from food history is a guy called Tommaso Marinetti, who in the early 1920s called for a ban on pasta. He was an Italian futurist, and he thought that pasta was a terrible thing. I think if you try and call for a ban on pasta in Italy, you're not going to get very far.
Why did he think it was such a terrible thing?
Because he said that it bloated the stomach and obscured men's minds and meant that men and women couldn't think properly. Mind you, he has his recipes that he came up with in his futurist cookbook are pretty extraordinary. He kind of instructs you to eat things while stroking sandpaper. And he comes up with sort of ideas for jam omelettes and food that should be eaten to the sound of blaring trumpets and having strange scents wafted over your face, which actually isn't completely dissimilar to what Ferinandra is doing today in Spain, or was doing until he shut down El Bui in Barcelona.
Well, I have to ask about cupcakes because Seattle over the last 10 years has had a bit of a cupcake renaissance to the point where we have stores all over the city that just specialize in cupcakes. Reading in your book, I found that cupcakes we need to credit to a woman named Eliza Leslie. Who was she?
Eliza Leslie was living in Philadelphia in the kind of early 1820s. And she wrote a book called 75 Receipts for Pastry, Cakes and Sweetmeats, in which there is what I think is the first recipe for a cupcake. And she was a sort of doyen of the Philadelphia cooking scene. She didn't just write books about food. She also produced manuals for how young ladies should go about their way. I mean, she came up with terrific advice. She told young women, do not volunteer to visit a friend in the country. She told people told girls that they shouldn't play pianos in public unless invited. and that a woman should never take two glasses of champagne. It is more than the head of an American female can bear. So she was giving all this tremendous advice as well as dishing out recipes for cupcakes. So I think that as far as I can see, we can pin the blame on the cupcake obsession on Eliza Leslie. I'm not quite sure who we can pin the blame on for the new cupcake, which is the donut, or there's the cronut, isn't there?
Yes.
That's the latest horror in the States.
When you're looking at ancient times, there's less recipes to choose from just because there's less written down. But then you get into modern times where a lot is written down. So how did you decide what gets into the book and what doesn't, as far as telling the story?
Well, for example, there's a recipe for chocolate cake in this book, which comes from the 1920s. Now, I think that a history of food has to have a recipe for chocolate cake. But the recipe for chocolate cake that I use was a recipe that was used to advertise a particular brand of chocolate that was being stocked in a supermarket or a new grocery store. And so I use that recipe for a way in to tell the story of the modern supermarket, because it was sold in a store called Piggly Wiggly, which was invented by an amazing man called Clarence Saunders, who was a young, poor guy, very little money, who found his métier in the grocery trade. And he was coming back from Indiana looking for inspiration in the early stages of his business. Because the big problem in those days, in the 20s and before that, was the inefficiencies in the retail trade, and that, you know, people would queue up at your store at lunchtime, men in white coats would hand you foods from the counters, from the shelves, you put it in your basket and you go home. So, which meant, of course, that people were rushed off their feet at lunchtime, had nothing to do the rest of the day. And he was on a train thinking about, how do I solve this problem? When his train slowed down, he looked out of the window and he was going past a pig farm, and he saw a mother sow feeding her 8 piglets, and he hit on the idea. He went, self-service. And 3 months later, he opened the first Piggly Wiggly. And it enabled people to walk down aisles, choose products themselves, choose products that they'd seen advertised, that were being marketed. Companies like Campbell's Soup, Walter Baker & Co. Chocolate Company, who produced the chocolate cake recipe that I feature in the book. And he revolutionized the way that we shop. He made a fortune. He built a pink palace clad in pig-inspired pink render, built a swimming pool, golf course, an indoor bowling alley, and then went bust. And he was banned from trading under his own name because he'd broken a few New York Stock Exchange trading laws. So he dusted himself down and he opened a new store called Clarence Saunders, Sole Owner of My Name Stores, which just shows you how angry he was. And that didn't go too well. Then he came back with an invention called the Cadoozle, which was a sort of rather like an arcade game where you put money in a slot and you manipulate a hand, pick up food and put it onto a conveyor belt, except they all broke and didn't work. And then on his deathbed, he came up with a thing called Food Electric, which he said would, again, revolutionize shopping, because he would put little codes on packages and a machine would be able to read what they were, and you put your money in the slot and paid for them, which, of course, is exactly how so many of us shop today, but he was a bit ahead of his time.
There's some modern recipes in this book, too, that are consumerism-based, you know, Campbell's Soup-based. Are there certain recipes in there that you included that we just would not serve anymore, even though they happened within the 20th century?
Well, there are recipes in here that I publish, but I wouldn't recommend you cook them, purely because you won't be able to. So while there are recipes that are technically difficult and maybe filthy from ancient times, I wouldn't personally, even though I do run it over several pages, recommend the steamed brioche with rose-scented mozzarella, because it's one of Ferinandria's dishes, and most of you probably haven't got the equipment that you need to do that. And likewise, meat fruit, which is the last recipe in the book by Heston Blumenthal, because you need quite a lot of complicated technical equipment, not just water baths and hydrogenators and dredgy pans and all this sort of stuff.
By meat fruit, you mean like foie gras? That's what.
Yeah, meat fruit was a dish that Heston and his chef partner Ashley Palmer-Watts invented, and it harks back to medieval days when food was often presented as one thing when it was the other. So it was so his meat fruit pretends to be fruit, where of course it's actually meat, because what it is a chicken liver parfait dipped in a mandarin jelly, and the mandarin dries, but the surface texture looks like that of a mandarin, and so he puts also a little mandarin leaf in it when he serves it. So you think you're about to have fruit, but of course it's just a delicious chicken liver parfait. So it's a very complicated dish. It's a beautiful dish. It tells a great story, but I would say don't try this at home.
I'm speaking with William Sitwell. He's author of the new book, A History of Food in 100 Recipes, and he's the editor of Waitrose Kitchen Magazine. And this book must have taken you quite some time to put together.
I bashed it out quite quickly. I mean, I had quite a strict deadline, and I wrote it in about 6 months in my spare time and evenings because I have a full-time job. And it was complete torture, actually. I was writing about 7,000 words a week. And if anyone ever tells me, if any farmer grabs my hands and goes, "You don't know a day's work," you know, I go, I hit the keyboard very hard when I write. So I know physical exertion. It's a lot of work to pump out 140,000 words, but it was fascinating. I mean, I spent a lot of time in the British Library in London, which is the most amazing resource. You can get your hands on really beautiful, old, precious books, which I think it demonstrates the beauty of print over digital, because you really can have an emotional response when you pick up a precious tome written by some, you know, undiscovered, forgotten food hero from 200 years ago, because it means a lot. There's a wonderful man called Denis Papin who wrote a book in the 18th century called The Steam Digester, or Engine for Softening Bones. And this guy invented the modern pressure cooker, except that all of his beautifully, carefully conducted experiments and all his drawings, which are in his book, were ignored by the Royal Society when he presented his ideas, and he died a pauper. And 10 years after his death, someone else patented his ideas and made a fortune. But to get hold of books written by those people really does fire up the imagination.
Yeah, and it fills in the storyline of humanity.
Exactly. Really. I mean, there's one of my great heroes from food history is a guy called Thomas Coriat. And he wrote a book called Coriat's Crudities, which came out in 1611. And he made two astonishing discoveries on a trip to Italy, which he writes in his book, which I got hold of a copy. The first, it was a morning after he drank a lot of Piedmont wine and he was suffering from a hangover. First thing he came across was an umbrella, which he saw someone walking down the street, shading themselves from the sun. And his friends told him when he reported that back in London, it'll never take off. And then in the afternoon, he discovered the fork. He was in an inn. And saw some Italian gentlemen eating with a fork, and he thought, this is amazing. Because, of course, up till then, and beyond, actually, people just used bread and knives to shovel food into their mouths. So he came back to England, wrote about this fork, and everyone laughed at him. His friends called him furcifer, which is an old English word for pitchfork. They said, this will never catch on. Who needs forks?
All these years later. So how has your understanding of the history of food changed your own experience with eating food?
That's a tough one, really. I mean, I educated myself massively about just general social history from writing this thing. I realized how incredibly ignorant I was of general history. It showed me that actually, if you write about a history of food, you learn a lot about the history of people. Because without, you know, food is so essential to everything that we do, culturally, historically, economically. It's fun, it's important, it's life-changing, you know. It really drove home the idea that food is an incredibly important subject, whether it's just about healthy eating or just about enjoyment. So it made me think about it more carefully. Writing the book really drew my attention to the problems of mass consumerism. There's a wonderful woman called Frances Moore Lappe who was writing in 1971. She was the first proponent in the US for a meat-free diet because she talked about the inadequacies of converting grain to meat and the loss of protein and calories and the amount of water you have to use in doing that. And so it makes me think a little bit more carefully about what I eat. But at the end of the day, you know, you can't take it so seriously, and you can get weighed down with all the world's problems of food. And I think that if you're presented with a nice self-sourcing chocolate fondant with a gooey middle and a little dollop of cream, the world can be a much more beautiful place.
William Sitwell is the editor of Waitrose Kitchen Magazine, and he's also the author of the new book, A History of Food in 100 Recipes. Thanks so much for coming by.
Great pleasure. Thank you.
William Sitwell spoke with KUOW's Katie Sewell. It's 9:41. A conversation about technology and social change in a minute on KUOW 94.9 Seattle. Right now is a great time to renew your annual KUOW membership or make a special gift. On June 30th, we close the books on our current fiscal year. Every gift made before June 30th is an investment in the reliable journalism and intelligent programming you'll enjoy today, tomorrow, and all year long. So please mail in your gift today or go online, kuow.org. And thanks. A wet day in Seattle. It's been rainy this morning, and the forecast says we're going to have showers through the day, a high of 69, currently 57 degrees.
Support for KUOW comes from the Seattle Aquarium, announcing the opening of the new Harbor Seal exhibit. The exhibit provides improved access and interaction for visitors of all ages and an enhanced environment for the seals. Learn more at seattleaquarium.org.
It's 9:42. Opening statements today in the trial of George Zimmerman, the Florida man charged with murdering unarmed teenager Trayvon Martin. That's in the news at 11.
From 94.9 KUOW, I'm Marcy Silman. Ron Aglash is a mathematician and a cyberneticist, and you can look up those words and still be a little bit confused. Professor Aglash works with the intersections between technology, community development, culture, and race. He's a professor in the Department of Science and Technology Studies at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, and he joins us in the studios today, and he's going to demystify all those words for us, or at least try to, right?
I'll do my best.
Do your best. Well, you're an ethnomathematician, which is something I've never heard of. So what is that exactly?
So ethnomathematician is somebody who brings together anthropology, which is the study of culture, with mathematics, and in particular mathematical modeling. So we're very interested in how you can use geometry or algebra or some other formal system to describe something that folks are doing out in their daily lives in some culture.
How did you get interested in that field?
Well, I was getting my engineering degree at UCLA and worked at National Semiconductor as an engineer for a little while. And then I went back to school in cultural studies in a program called History of Consciousness at University of California at Santa Cruz. And so I was trying to bring the engineering background together with this cultural and political analysis. And I thought that looking at third world development, technology transfer might be a good place to do that. So that's where I got started with this.
Was one of the sort of assumptions or questions behind wanting to do that the fact that we're not particularly culturally savvy when we export technologies from the U.S. to, say, the African subcontinent?
Well, yeah. So that was the technology development literature. But there was one particular study that caught my eye. There was an anthropologist, Pat Kaplan, who had done a study in Tanzania. And she described how women in this one village had a lot of autonomy. So even though it was a Muslim culture, they could divorce their husbands if they wanted to. If their kids were bothering them, they would go and build a little house for the kids. If they wanted to divorce their husband, they would build a house for themselves. So the architecture, their ability to have usufructory rights to the land, as we say, to be able to use a piece of land whenever they needed to, that was tied to their social independence. Hmm. Now, they had a modernization program where they would bring in concrete blockhouses and put them in roads. And so the anthropologist said, you know, it seems like this is going to be a disaster for women's autonomy in this village. Well, I knew what concrete blockhouses and roads looked like. It's like a Cartesian grid, mm-hmm. right? But what did the village look like before that? So I wrote to her and asked her if she could send me some aerial photographs of that village, and she did. They weren't terribly good aerial photographs, but something clicked, and I thought, you know, that looks kind of like a fractal.
Okay, explain fractal. I had to ask my teenage son, and I'm still not sure I understand anything more except repeating pattern.
That's about it. So it's a pattern that repeats at different scales. So when you look at my face, I'm symmetric, right? The right half of my face looks like the left half of my face.
Mm-hmm.
But that's symmetry within the same scale. When we talk about scaling symmetry, we mean a resemblance between different scales. So a little piece looks like the big piece.
So a little bit like those Russian Kachinka dolls that nest inside one another?
Kind of like the Russian dolls, but they're symmetric to one point, and these are globally symmetric. I'll show you a better example of that. So look at your thumb and your index finger, and there's a place where the two of them meet.
All right.
And you need to relax your hand a little bit there. So now you've got kind of a big wrinkle there.
Yes.
And within that, you can see some smaller wrinkles. And within that, you can see some smaller wrinkles.
So
a tree has a branch of a branch of a branch. A cloud has a puff of a puff of a puff.
I see.
So mountains are jaggedness within jaggedness.
So this is like me as a kid laying there on the ground thinking about how vast the universe might be. And
kind of like that, yeah.
Oh, my. Okay. Well, we're talking with Ron Eglash, who's, as you hear, trying to make this comprehensible to a math-phobic individual. So you saw this aerial photograph, and you thought about concrete blockhouses and how that wasn't at all what this village would have been on its own merits.
Yeah.
Rows of houses, not it.
Not rows of houses. So these were houses that are shaped like a cylinder, what we often call a hut, but hut comes from a German word that means shack. It's a little bit derogatory, so I just use the word house.
Mm.
So they're houses that are shaped like a cylinder, but the houses are in circles. So it's a circle of circles. And that circle is in circles. So it's a circle of circle of circles.
Is that layout conscious? Was it, or is that the aesthetic of this particular community?
Well, the reason I talked about trees and clouds and wrinkles on our skin is because that's where fractals had been applied. So before I started looking at the cultural material, all the examples I had heard of were in nature.
Mm-hmm.
And nature doesn't have a conscious way of self-organizing things into fractals. If you look at termite mounds, those are fractals. If you look at coral reefs, those are fractals. But it's not like termites understand fractal geometry.
Sure.
They didn't take classes in it or anything.
Probably not, no.
So my assumption was that Africans were doing the same thing. It was just unconscious social dynamics from the bottom up, so to speak, that was causing these fractals. It wasn't until I got to Africa and started interviewing people that I found out there was a whole other side to it.
You went to Ghana, is that right, where you did?
The initial field work I did was in seven different countries. So Senegal, Mali, Burkina Faso, Ghana, Cameroon, and Benin.
A little earlier this hour, we played a clip of you saying you would knock on people's doors and say, hey, can I go up on your roof? I'm a mathematician. I want to check it out. And people would say yes.
Well, not everybody's door, but yeah. So occasionally I needed to get up in elevation and you have to talk people into letting you do that, which is not a normal request.
And as I understand from a presentation that you gave, a TED Talk that you gave, this organization, this architectural community organization, the infrastructure organization, actually sort of goes back to the spiritual religious organization, it sounded like, for some of these locations.
In a lot of cases, yeah. I didn't find one underlying reason for why people were building fractals. So you go to one village and they give you one explanation, and a different village they give you a different explanation. But a lot of them were very tied into a kind of cosmology or spiritual belief, yes.
So these go back centuries, the fractal organization of African villages. And that's great, and it's fascinating on an academic level. What do you do with this field work? You are a professor of science and technology, not of... Well, maybe you are a professor of fractal geometry, but I don't think you are. So you go do this field work. You've written books about this, but what does that mean for this African village or for me?
I think you're moving a little quick to the practical.
Okay. You want to take me one?
We should just celebrate the discovery. It's absolutely fascinating.
Okay, I'm sorry. So I don't mean to take anything away from what you do.
here you've got Europeans for centuries focusing on Euclidean geometry, on circles and squares and rectangles. And it wasn't until relatively recently that they started looking at this other way of thinking about geometric organization.
So
that in itself is a pretty significant result.
Does it also indicate a huge cultural gap in assumptions that we've made about Africa?
Absolutely. Yeah. So when we apply this work, a lot of it is in the field of education. And when I speak to teachers that have large numbers of African-American students in the classroom, sometimes they're a little bit skeptical. And some of them have even said to me, well, I think my kids are ashamed of being of African descent. I don't think they want to have anything to do with Africa. And the reason for that is centuries of these assumptions that there's a kind of ladder of progress and Africans are on the bottom and Europeans are on the top. So this is a wonderful opportunity to upset that ladder in a kind of academic, intellectual way.
Now, from African village fractals, there's something much closer to home that you've looked at, and that's people's heads.
Yeah. So when I first started working with math teachers and asking about this, I asked them, out of all the examples in the book, what do you think your kids would connect with the most? And they all said the same thing. They said, oh, the fractals in cornrow hairstyles, that's something that kids can connect to because that's part of the living culture. That's still something people are innovating with. So that was our first simulation that we put online. And the National Science Foundation was very generous in helping us develop that further. And so now we have lots of these simulations.
So essentially what, if I look at cornrows, the way that those are fractals is those that are repeating, the braiding patterns are repeated patterns that are large to small.
Yes, and large to small. They're scaling patterns.
Scaling patterns, and they can, some cornrow patterns are quite elaborate. Some are straight. They're zigzag.
So you're actually getting into one of the first problems we encountered. So we'd show this to teachers, and they'd say, well, that's awesome, but we don't have any fractal geometry in the K-12 curriculum. So how are you going to help us? So we started breaking down the simulations into the topics that were in the math curriculum, and the most natural connection was with what's called transformational geometry. So there are four geometric transforms. There's rotation, reflection, translation, and scaling or dilation. So if you iteratively, in a loop, so to speak, apply a transformation, you can get copies that get smaller and smaller and smaller, right? That's your mm-hmm. scaling transformation. And you can get copies that rotate a little bit each time. So that's your rotation, right? And you can have a braid that's very squished together or spread far apart. That's your translation. And then, of course, since we often do things that are symmetric with our heads, you get reflection. So all four of those geometric transformations can be found in cornrow braiding, but the fact that you're doing them iteratively and that they scale down lets you make the connection to fractals.
So you can use this to teach younger kids math because it's concrete, it's in their lives.
Yes. But you're not only teaching them mathematics, you're also teaching them a sense of ownership over the mathematics.
Because you're tying it to a cultural heritage.
Yes, which we do all the time. So we're constantly tying math to European heritage. So we say, here's the Pythagorean theorem, and maybe we have a little picture of a marble bust of Pythagoras. Mm. So this is a great way of giving other kids a sense of that heritage, identity, and mathematics.
So this fractals, for example, is this just African, or are you finding this sort of organization of a cultural identity in other continents, other places on Earth?
Well, that's why we have the discipline of ethnomathematics. So we do find, I call them geometric design themes. We do find different geometric design themes in different cultures. So one of the groups I've been working a lot with are Native Americans. And there you tend to find things that are set up like the Cartesian coordinate system. So you have the four winds, the four directions, the Navajo have four sacred mountains. Mm-hmm. Many cultures have four sacred colors. The persistence of fourfold symmetry is incredibly strong in Native American design. Now, a few years back, I was invited to come out to the Shoshone-Bannock Reservation in Idaho and work with some of the math teachers there. And I told them that, you know, my African Fractals book, I had made a contrast between the fractals in Africa and the lack of fractals in Native American design. And they said, well, come out anyways. So I got out there, and everybody was doing this beautiful beadwork. So we created a virtual bead loom. And immediately started getting these ugly, jagged lines in it. So I asked my software developer, you know, how come the Native American beadwork looks so much nicer than your beadwork? And he said, I don't know. So we went back to the reservation and did some more interviews and found out they were using a different algorithm than the algorithm that my developer was using. So we left both of those up there on the simulation so kids can see the difference between the way that he was thinking about it and the way the bead workers were thinking about it.
That was Dr. Ron Eglash. He's a cyberneticist, a professor at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute in New York State, an author, and an ethnomathematician. Dr. Eglash's work focuses on how complexity theory and nanotechnology can make impacts on social change. He recently co-edited a book called Appropriating Technology. This is Weekday. And now, the sound of the day. Okay, that's a sound of summer for listener Cindy. It's captured on the last day of school at Bothell's Canyon Creek Elementary School. The sound of buses fully loaded with kids rounding the drive as teachers blow bubbles, hold flags, and wave the kids off into their summer vacation. Cindy says it's the best day of the year. I'm not sure, is she a teacher? Or is she, no, is she one of the...
Sounds like the loudest day of the year at
yeah.
school.
No kidding. I'm not sure I've ever heard that kind of celebration. What interesting sounds are you listening to? Record 30 seconds of what you hear and send that sound to us along with the story behind the sound. You can email it to weekday@kuow.org and include sound of the day in the subject line. And Cindy, I'm curious, since you think this is the best day of the year, if you are listening today, let us know why it's the best day of the year for you. And speaking of sound, we want your theme songs. You can start thinking about what song defines you as you enter a room. And in about 5 minutes, we're going to ask you to call 206-543-KUOW.
Newly obtained documents show a Tacoma soldier was killed by friendly fire, not combat. KUOW's Lisa Brooks has more on that in the news, which is right around the corner here. KUOW FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
Support for KUOW comes from Foster Pepper, providing business and regulatory legal counsel to all types of banks and financial institutions throughout the region. Online at foster.com and on Twitter. When it happens, Foster Pepper is there.
Hello.
Hey, Benjamin Walker.
Where are you?
The cloud.
You're calling from the cloud?
Yeah.
What's it like there?
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at kuow.org.